This is the Ask EFF panel, so check to see if you're in the right place. We are the Electronic Frontier Foundation. We're very proud to have an opportunity to be here at DEF CON. We love coming here. We view this as, you know, our people. We don't have to actually explain what we do here at DEF CON. People actually already understand it, and that's just wonderful for us. This is the Ask EFF panel, so we're not going to talk very much. I've asked each of the lawyers who are with me tonight and Seth Schoen, who's one of our technologists, to give maybe 2 minutes about a particular topic that we're working on so you can hear a little bit about. And then we want to open it up for questions. So I'm going to have each of the lawyers give a short presentation, and then we're going to show a little video that we did about your tools and why you should stand up to defend them. And while that's playing, if you have questions, why don't you go ahead and line up, and when the video's done, we'll just take questions for the rest of the time. A couple of rules. This is your chance to ask the EFF attorneys questions. However, if you've got a serious legal problem, don't do it in a public place. You do not have the attorney-client privilege if you ask us in front of 100 strangers about your legal problems. If you have a real legal problem, please come see us privately, and we'll be happy to sit down and talk with you. We not only help people, but we do a lot of work finding lawyers for people.
Okay,
and we're happy to do that, but please do not reveal any of your secrets or anything you've done wrong. This is not confession time. So please do not do that. My name is Cindy Cohen. I'm the legal director of the Electronic Frontier Foundation. Thank you. I'd like to give a special welcome to all the members of law enforcement who may be with us in the audience here tonight. Thank you very much for coming. How many people here are Electronic Frontier Foundation members? Yay for you. Thank you very, very much. And the rest of you, why not? Hopefully by the end of this, we'll be able to do that. How many people have ever used our Action Center and sent a letter to your congressman or somebody? Thank you. Thank you very, very much. When we go to try to argue for something in Congress in front of an agency, we really stand on the shoulders of all the people who take action on EFF, so that, you know, I can stand up and say, those 5,000 letters you got, I'm the person you have to talk to about the issue that those constituents of yours raised. So you really raise us up so that we have a lot more leverage when you take action on these things. So thank you. Without further ado, I want to talk a little bit about one of the issues that I'm working on at EFF, and then we'll go through the lawyers, and they'll each give a little spiel. I wanted to talk a little bit about electronic voting machines. As I think most people are aware of now, and if not, you should be, the electronic voting machines that are now being introduced in jurisdictions across the country are far less secure than the slot machines out there in this casino. Most of them are built on Windows 2000 systems. I don't see why I love DEF CON. Say no more, right? This is not a secure system. It's not a way to make sure your vote is being counted as cast. This is an issue that EFF picked up early on, and we've been working on now for several years. It doesn't show any sign of ending. We've had some great successes. We've got 26 states to pass laws requiring a voter verifiable paper trail for electronic voting systems. It's not the only solution, but it's the best one we have right now. It's a very good start. But we have a lot more to do, because we've had all sorts of craziness, like people doing an electronic voting machine with a voter-verified paper trail, and then they refuse to actually count the paper, saying it's a little too hard for them to do that. So we've got a lot more work to do to shore that up, but we've had some great victories so far. Last year, we basically scared the worst of them all, the voting company known as Diebold, out of the state of North Carolina with some litigation that we brought there. And thank you. And we're continuing on. This is an issue that I think people don't like to think about in between elections, but EFF is there in the trenches and even when times are quiet, working on that issue, and we're going to continue to do so. I know there's a panel, I think, Sunday morning on electronic voting with a guy named Mr. Hansen, who is from the Accurate Project. It's a great topic, and he knows a lot about it, so if you're interested in that, I suggest you catch that. So next, I'd like to introduce Kevin Bankston, and he's going to talk a little bit about some of what he's doing at EFF.
Hi, I'm Kevin. I'm a staff attorney working on free speech and privacy issues. Most of my time right now is devoted to our lawsuit against AT&T. Thank you. In case you haven't heard, we allege that NSA has owned AT&T's network. and with AT&T's permission, in which case I'm not really sure they're owning it. A little semantic problem there. And also that AT&T is disclosing the entirety of its database of records about who you call and who you email and when and for how long, et cetera, in violation of a laundry list of longstanding statutes and the Fourth Amendment of the Bill of Rights. This is going to be a long, hard case, and we're finding it very long and hard. But the conventional wisdom was that when the government intervened in our case, arguing that it should be dismissed because our case would reveal state secrets, that we were going to get our asses kicked. But we kicked ass. We got a decision. Thanks. 2 weeks ago, we got a great decision from Judge Vaughn Walker in the Northern District of California saying our case was not going to be dismissed. It was going to go forward. Now that's going, of course, to appeal, and that'll probably end up before the Supreme Court before it's said and done. But like I said, we're going to fight it long and hard. The problem is now there's a bill working its way through Congress that could end the game. It would essentially give the president a blank check, or at least a very, very large check, when it comes to foreign intelligence surveillance. And most relevant for us, it would shuffle our legal challenge and all the other legal challenges involved in the NSA program into a secret court in D.C., which its only job for the past 30 years has been to secretly approve government applications for wiretaps. So basically, forum shopping of the worst kind, they want to put them all in the one court most likely to legitimate what the president's been doing. So if you walk out of here with one action item, it needs to be this. Go to our action center and call your senator and say you oppose the Specter-Cheney bill. And if you want to learn more about that bill and learn more about our case against AT&T, we do have a panel specifically about that at noon on Sunday. In the interest of time, I'm not going to really talk about anything else right now other than to say one other fun issue we're working on is cell phone tracking. The government apparently has been routinely tricking judges into giving them orders to track cell phones' location without a warrant, without probable cause, based on legal arguments that the courts are now calling, thanks in part to our briefing, unsupported, misleading, contrived, a Hail Mary, so convoluted as to be perverse, and so convoluted as to be likened to a three-well bank shot in pool. this just goes to show that when the government is the only person making the argument in closed proceedings, they push the line as far as they can. It's our job to push back, and it seems we're doing a pretty good job of it. Thanks to you. Thank you.
Next up is Kurt Opsahl.
Hello, I'm Kurt Opsahl, a staff attorney with EFF, working on free speech and privacy issues. I'm also working on the AT&T case, but what I wanted to talk to you about were a couple of cases that we worked on over the last year that you might find interesting. One is the Apple v. Doe's case, and this is a case involving a subpoena to online journalists for their confidential sources. Apple sued some Doe's, unknown people, presumably employees who had leaked some information about an upcoming product. This was written up in some online magazines, as is often the case before Macworld. These things leak out and get published. But in this case, they filed suit, they issued some subpoenas, and attempted to argue that these journalists did not deserve the reporter's privilege. It shouldn't be applied to them. We fought back. We took that through the California Court of Appeal and got a great decision that upholds and defends the rights of online journalists to protect the confidentiality of their sources. Fought back against a trial court decision that had made the privilege inapplicable where someone asserts trade secret rights. The decision was so good that Apple decided not to appeal it further. So we've now come to a final decision on that. The second issue that we worked on was the Sony rootkit debacle. As you may recall, late last year, it became known that Sony had placed a rootkit on some of its as part of some of its DRM. digital rights management software, software designed to stop you from being able to easily copy their disks. And in addition, that was one type of software. We did a further investigation with the help of ISEC partners and their good work. We're able to find another security flaw in the MediaMax software, which was the second flavor of DRM that Sony was using, where they had enabled a privilege escalation attack. Brought that also to the attention of Sony, and were able to get them to get a patch out for it. We eventually were able to reach a settlement with Sony where they are not issuing this DRM anymore. They are reconsidering their entire DRM strategy. Those who bought the defective discs can get their music in an unencumbered format, and we're pretty pleased in how that works out. We hope that sends a message to other companies that are considering using DRM in their software. Thank you.
Next up is one of our intellectual property lawyers, Jason Schultz.
Hey there. So I'm Jason Schultz. I work on more of the intellectual property side of issues at EFF. And for those who don't know, that used to be something people didn't think was such an affront to maybe freedom. But I think most of you know that intellectual property can be used to shut down a lot of people doing a lot of interesting, useful, and socially beneficial things. One of the things I do is a project called the Patent Busting Project. And so you can check that out more on our site. But just recently, there's been a lot more patents issuing on all kinds of things that shouldn't be issued on. But also, there's been a lot more threats. In fact, just recently, a company called Blackboard has started going after university content course management systems, including open source based systems. And so there's going to be a lot more of that going on where the so-called patent trolls are actually going to go after all kinds of people, not just the Microsofts of the world, but small little projects as well. So we'll be watching that. A couple other things I wanted to mention. There's a case going on in Oklahoma where a single mom has fought back against the RAA and got her case dismissed. So we're going to be supporting her, and she's going to ask for her attorney's fees back, and we'll hopefully get a little money back from the RAA on that. There are a lot of, so hopefully that'll start a precedent so we can start to shift that balance a little bit. Also, there are a lot of lawsuits going on right now against Google for some of its indexing and searching capabilities and things like that. And we're definitely involved in that to the extent that we want to make sure that your ability to access and index information that you find on the web or elsewhere stays free and open, and that copyright holders can't come and shut you down for that. And then I just want to flag one issue. It's not a real case that we're involved with right now. A few things have popped up, but just for on the radar, there's going to be a lot of intellectual property litigation, I think, in virtual worlds, virtual gaming worlds, Second Life, things like that. So we're definitely keeping our radar on for that as well, because I think there's going to be a few people who get into fights on there, if you know what I mean. Thank you.
Thanks. Next up is our brand spanking newest attorney. Marsha Hoffman has just joined us, and we've just opened a small EFF office in Washington, D.C., where she and another lawyer will be working out of. And they're going to be focusing on trying to open up this government to get its secrets out and get as much of that information out to us, the members of the public, so we can make informed choices about our government again. Marsha?
Hi there. My name is Marsha Hoffman. As Cindy mentioned, I am EFF's newest staff attorney. This is my fourth day on the job. It's a great place to be, my fourth day on the job, speaking at DEF CON. I'm happy to be here, and I'm glad you all are excited about what we do. I want to tell you a little bit about the project we're going to be doing out of Washington. There's this law that some of you may be familiar with called the Freedom of Information Act, or FOIA. This is a federal law that gives everyone the right to ask the government for information about what it does. And we are going to use this law to submit a bunch of requests for information about the government's development of technology, the government's use of that technology to conduct surveillance on the public, and the private sector's cooperation with the government to conduct that kind of surveillance or to otherwise infringe upon Americans' rights. And we are going to make this information public. The documents that we get, we're going to put on our website. We're going to make them available to decision makers in Congress and other places. And we're going to make them available to the press. so that they can report on what we find and also develop investigative journalistic endeavors. So I hope that you all will keep an eye out for what we're doing. And, you know, of course, one of the big things that's important in our work is coming up with ideas for what to ask for. And if any of you have ideas for things that EFF should make FOIA requests about, by all means, pull me aside while I'm here, while you're here, or send me an email. Thank you.
Now, what a great place to work, right? Your fourth day, and we bring you to DEF CON, and we put you on stage. Now, come on. Yeah, buy Marcia a drink. She's a good egg. So the last person is Seth Schoen, and Seth has the great distinction of being the only non-lawyer on our panel. Seth, EFF, thank you. EFF has lots of lawyers, but we also have quite a few techs, and Seth is one of our favorites, and he's going to talk to you a little bit about some of the more some technical stuff that we're up to.
Thanks. I wanted to show you a movie, a cartoon that some of our colleagues have put together. I'm a little worried about the volume level because earlier it was kind of blasting. So let's give it a try, and I apologize if your ears get blasted a little bit. This cartoon was developed for primarily non-technical audiences. So if you as a technical audience are amused by that, you can take it as a sort of ironic thing or feel cynical about it or something. But it was designed certainly, as you'll see, for a non-technical audience.
Okay, we're live to the future in five.
That's pretty loud.
He said he could do it. I can't quite. It'll do it.
He said okay, thanks. Except I can't see what I'm doing because I don't have it on here.
Okay, there it is.
There we go. Okay.
Okay, we're live to the future in 5, 4, 3.
In 2006, the entertainment industry asked the government to give them incredible new powers. But here in the future, those superpowers have become the Corruptibles. No one is safe. Take the innocent act of making a mix CD for your loved one, made from those tunes you heard on your new digital radio. The law says that's legal. But under the music industry's digital radio laws, the Corruptibles can stop any receiver that helps you record particular songs and many other legitimate uses. Looking forward to high-definition digital TV in the future? If you value your freedom to use TiVo and other gadgets, you'll be disappointed.
Take the bunny!
Sure, kids. I know it's your favorite.
Under the broadcast flag law, the Corruptibles can keep any digital TV recorder that isn't Hollywood-approved out of your hands forever. Even computer-savvy kids making amazing school projects have to be on the lookout. The movie industry's analog hole bill requires anti-copying spy chips to be included in computers by law. Digitizing even a short sample is detected by the Corruptibles and eliminated. The future. New superpowers everywhere. Fighting innocent consumers, breaking new gadgets. Is there anyone out there who can fight back? Over to you in the present.
Remember, the Corruptibles are not real, but the powers they're using could be. Don't let the entertainment industry try this at home. Find out more about the proposed laws and call your representative now.
So I go to a lot of meetings where I actually fight against some of these people, and it might be kind of cool if they had the superpowers, although I might not escape with my life. But as it is, actually, the Corruptibles are sort of stand-ins for people who wear suits and are lawyers and get paid to go to meetings in industry groups around the world. And it's a little less exciting than the heat vision, but they have their own lawyer superpowers. And our lawyers have, you know, our own lawyer superpowers too, so it's pretty great. So, as the movie suggests, you might have thought that things were bad enough with the DMCA and that the DMCA provided a depressing enough rule and a depressing enough regime for technology regulation. But it turns out that the movie industry and the recording industry are not satisfied, and they have not been willing to stop there. And they're still every day engaging in legislative advocacy, trying to get even more powers and more restrictions that go beyond the DMCA. And there are these three specific areas in which this legislation is a very real threat to existing devices that you can buy now and use now. And we're fighting these, and we really need help in this advocacy. We really need people to contact legislators and to say, you know, I thought the entertainment industry's already had plenty of power, and now they want to ban our ability to record analog video, our ability to, well, the digital radio one is complicated because they don't like the idea that you can pick out a particular song. They say you should be able to record, but as long as you don't know what's on the radio, and as long as you can't pick out particular songs by name or by artist. So the devices need to be built specifically so that they don't tell you that in the user interface as a way of, you know, setting a recording preference. And then for digital television, we've been fighting the digital television broadcast flag for 4 years, almost 5 years now, ever since it was first proposed. As many of you may be aware, together with the American Library Association and Public Knowledge, we beat the FCC in court and got the court to throw out the broadcast flag rule. And that happened over a year ago now. But the movie industry is right back in Congress, asking for Congress to write a new law that will give the FCC power to do this. And among legislators, that law is not considered terribly controversial, because industry, large parts of industry have accepted it as inevitable. So we really need help from the public to say, not only is this not inevitable, it's a ridiculous idea. So we have our action center, action.eff.org, which several people have mentioned here, provides information about some of the bills that we're currently concerned about or interested in, and means of contacting legislators. You can also find out, you can ask us, you can come to our booth, you can read on our website, about devices that are currently threatened by legislation. You can go out and buy them while you can still get them. Even simple things like a video card that can record from an analog input is something that people have tried to ban in its present form. The Slingbox and a nice device called the Neuros that lets you lawfully get things like DVD onto a video iPod or a portable player. All of these things are under threat. Also, for those of you who are electrical engineers, you can build some of these things, help make them more available to people while that's still lawful. And we look forward to talking to all of you about what we can do about this to try to stop the entertainment industries from getting even further additional powers over technology. Thanks a lot.
Okay, so this is the ask part of the Ask EFF panel. So if you've got questions, please line up in front of the microphone so the audience can hear your questions as well as our answers. That makes things work better. We'd be happy to take as many as we can while the time arrives. By the way, we do have a booth over in the swag area over there, and you're welcome to come visit us. There's also a dunk tank outside. It's a little hidden. You have to go back through the game room, and there's a little outside courtyard. There's going to be a dunk tank going throughout the weekend, and all the proceeds for the dunk tank go to the Electronic Frontier Foundation, so it's a way to not only get your friends wet, but do a little something good on the side as well. Yes?
Hi, I think this one's for Jason in particular. I'm sorry, did I get your name right?
Yeah.
Okay. A lot of higher educational institutions use products like UPortal or Sakai or open source portal type systems. What do you think Blackboard is actually going to do? Are they going to go after those companies directly, or perhaps use fear tactics to get universities to switch to other products such as Blackboard?
So that was a lawsuit, actually, I mentioned, so thanks for bringing up. It's a little unclear exactly what they're going for now. I think a lot of it's just intimidation. I mean, Sakai and some of these other projects, are pushing them in the marketplace to have to innovate and have to kind of keep up, maybe lower their prices. And I think this is their sort of shot across the bow. But they are suing people, so we'll see. I mean, from what I can tell, and actually what's sort of interesting, people have already created a Wikipedia page to post prior art on the patent, on the course management system patent, so we'll see how that goes. But I think it can almost have a backlash effect. I think it's just kind of a gut reaction. You get a lot of these companies who, once they acquire intellectual property, feel they have to assert intellectual property. It's like a gut reaction without even thinking it through. So It's hard to know, but Blackboard's actually sued lots of people for lots of crazy reasons. They've sued a bunch of kids who reverse engineered something they did before, and Georgia, and they're not really a good player in that sense. So I don't ascribe any good motivations to them all. I think they're just trying to intimidate people and keep their market share.
Next.
This question's kind of specific, but it's got some general principles that would apply. My company does open source hosting, specifically multimedia audio and video. So we get a lot of patents, and some of our stuff is broken DRM, so we've gotten DMCA takedowns and the like. For people who host open source software, especially things that are likely to infringe, are there any steps that can be taken above and beyond the DMCA safe harbor provisions to try to limit how likely you are to have to take stuff down and get sued and the like?
Well, on the patent front, the real problems with patent law right now in the sense that there really is no safe harbor, and there's actually a reform bill that's sort of working its way through Congress. It's not fully formed yet, so hopefully that will have some help. I mean, the best thing you can do is to really be in touch with the creators of the code. If you're the people who manage the open source project, then you should talk to me. And if you're not, talk to the people who distribute the binaries that you run or whatever, and they should talk to me or other people, because we're starting to do more work with them and helping them sort of figure out how to collect prior art and be prepared. And also there's a place called the Public Patent Foundation that's also doing some of this as well. But it's kind of early on. There's really no magic shield that you can have. It's a really rough area. I mean, the best thing you can do is prepare as much as possible so when you get that nasty letter, you know, we can write one back. That's kind of your best bet right now.
Yeah.
Well, if it's your software, he said some of it's his software, then, you know, we can talk later and we can figure out. And there are some pro bono patent lawyers that I've been able to wrangle to give advice and write letters and sort of help support efforts like yours. So we can also maybe hook you up with one of them who can actually be kind of your lawyer if we can't do everything.
Hi. I was wondering, is the EFF planning on doing anything to force corporations and government here in the United States to be more responsible as well as accountable for our personal financial data when it's overseas, especially in the hands of third-party corporations overseas?
Well, I think the short answer is not in the short term. I would love to, and if you guys want to raise enough money for me to hire a couple more lawyers to work on that, I would like to take that issue on because I think it's really important. I think that at the moment we're kind of maxed out on projects of that size. I apologize. I'd love to, you know, EFF is 25 people in a little office, and now we have two more in D.C., but in a little tiny office in the Mission District in San Francisco, I would like to be 10 times that size. So this is my challenge to DEF CON, raise enough money to us so that we can be 250 people instead of 25. And then we can take on a wider range of issues. I think the financial issues are important, but I don't think we can take them on right now because I don't think I have the resources to do it well. Sorry. I wish this is the hardest part of my job, you know. The number of people who call EFF or email EFF with serious, important issues that they'd like us to take on that I can't take on, that's the hardest part of my job every single day is making the calculation about whether we have the resources to do something and do it well. Because when we take something on, we take it on and we stick with it. So I'm not going to just say yes to everybody. We actually do a careful analysis before we do what we do because we're in this to win. We're not in this just to, you know, raise the flag and then go on to the next whiskey bar.
Hi. Let me see. My question has two parts, and you can opt out of the whole thing by saying, wow, this is out of our scope, if you'd like to. This spring, there was a really red-hot Freedom of Information Act request, George Washington University. It was from the Pentagon, Joint Chiefs. The information operations roadmap, where the internet was referred to regularly as an enemy combatant by the Pentagon, and outlined, you know, ostensibly the Pentagon making internet equivalents of nuclear weapons and that kind of thing to shut everybody down and do all kinds of other things, as well as stepping really far into military psyops indirectly aimed at the American public. A, are you guys involved in taking any action to monitor or get involved with this kind of event. I mean, I know you guys are talking a lot about media things, which set all kinds of legal precedents, which are stepping stones into much darker territory. This is dark. And second, if you guys do have somebody involved in this, who are they? And what can we do to help? Fourth day on the job. Let's do it.
Well, the best that I can say to that is I think it sounds like a very, very interesting subject for FOIA stuff. And, you know, I'd love to talk to you about it further. So, you know, maybe this isn't the time to do it right now, but, I mean,
shots.
Why don't we talk a little bit?
Yeah. All right.
Shots.
We'll do shots.
Shots. Yeah. That's the way to go. Find me.
So at Bruce Potter's Black Hat and DEF CON talks, he mentioned how the EFF and ACLU will sue companies that do evil things with trusted computing. I think his example was if a company required a remote attestation that you weren't running Mozilla Firefox on your machine before, it would give you, say, security updates or something like that. He reassured us that you guys would you know, take care of that, sort of. And he didn't really tell us what the legal theory would be that you would use in that kind of challenge. And I wonder if you could tell us what the legal theory would be and if maybe that means that you guys are so excited now about remote attestation that you think that maybe owner override isn't necessary because you've got this legal theory that I love to hear about.
You want to take this?
Well, I would refer to the lawyers over the question of legal theory.
Yeah, I'll do that.
My suspicion is that it would be difficult to sue companies that abuse trusted computing because we've seen a lot of companies that have done things that are not necessarily in their customers' interests, and there hasn't necessarily always been a legal remedy for that. So my impression hearing that earlier was that it's a very optimistic view of the law to think that EFF will always have a legal remedy against every company that does something against the interests of customers, whether that's through trusted computing or any other technological area.
But yes, so Seth answered the legal part, so I think that's right. I mean, one of the areas of law that we've been concerned about lately is EULA law and user license agreements and the ways that companies are using click-throughs and other contractual arrangements to try to limit what you can do with their tools and to limit your remedies if they've restricted you through the tools. You know, I think that a situation in which Microsoft, which they know how to do contracts, trust me on this, was to sell you a product that does require remote attestation before you can do things with it. And you know, clicked through or signed or got a licensing agreement as part of that product that said that that was what you agreed to, we'd have an uphill battle to get you out of that contract. Now, I'm not saying we wouldn't win, and I'm not saying we wouldn't take it on, but I think that it's not appropriate for the proponents of trusted computing to say, pay no attention to the excesses and the problems that this product might cause because EFF will come to the rescue and everything will automatically be all right. You know, we're good. We're damn good at what we do. But you guys have a responsibility as well not to create situations in which we have to come in and try to help people out. And I think that it's not responsible computing to just assume that whatever problems your technology creates are going to get sorted out by the do-gooders over there in the Mission District in San Francisco. I think you have an affirmative obligation to protect and to work towards to do ethical computing, quite apart from the fact that we're here to try to do the excesses. And frankly, I find it a bit, you know, troubling. We've got enough on our plate with the federal government, the AT&T, Sony BMG, the patent trolls. You know, why do we have to take on the technology companies too? I mean, why can't they be on our side? Frankly, not our side, your side. So I think that, you know, so I mean, I think the short answer is certainly nothing that that Bruce said led us to think that we don't like owner override anymore, which was Seth's insight into one of the ways to deal with the problems with trusted computing. He certainly said nothing today that changes my mind about that. And in fact, I think that we need to hold the people who are proponents of these technologies to a higher standard than to just throw off the possibility of problems and say, well, there's an EFF, so everything will ultimately be okay, even if I take no responsibility for making sure that people have tools that actually work for them as opposed to working against them.
All right. I'd like to know what the current legalities of encryption are in the U.S., and there's a bit of a stretch, how that might differ with, say, Canada. I'm from Toronto.
Oh, boy. Encryption, a topic near and dear to my heart for over 15 years. So the short answer is it's a long answer. Depending on the if you're doing open source crypto where you've got a open source license agreement and you're giving it away in the United States, you have an extremely trivial export analysis. So using encryption inside the United States and developing encryption inside the United States is completely legal and always has been. The problem has always come in the export of encryption, and the government has interpreted export very broadly, including things like posting it to the internet. So that's why a lot more things qualify as export than you might otherwise think. So if you've got open source things and stuff that you're giving away, you're not selling crypto, you have a very easy process where you basically send an email to the Bureau of Export Administration saying, I'm exporting this crypto, talk to you later, and you can do it. If you're selling crypto, it gets much more complicated, and there are lots of different levels, and the licensing gets more onerous depending on how you're doing it. It's still much, much better than it was when I first picked up this issue in 1994. We've made great, great strides, but you need counsel if you're going to sell. And similarly, if you're in Toronto and you want to publish stuff from there, come see me and we'll talk about it, because I don't want to bore these people with the complications of the import of crypto back across the borders kind of issue.
Okay, thank you.
I think Richard Stallman would be grateful if I pointed out that under those rules, if you sell open source crypto, then that counts as open source, and you are allowed to do that without getting the more elaborate permission. Free software.
I was wondering what the current state of getting arrested with a piece of like personal technology, like a smartphone or a thumb drive or a hard drive, is. The last precedent that I had heard is that they'd been grouped into the class of like a pager due to like early drug convictions, where they'd gotten into the pager and had full access when the person was arrested. Is that true of kind of higher level devices that a lot of us carry around that have email and gigs of information now?
This is still a pretty developing area of Fourth Amendment law, but generally when you are arrested, they can search you and all of your effects as an incident to arrest. And so far we haven't had a very good luck in getting courts or the government to recognize that it's a very distinct, very different thing to be able to say search your bag, which can hold a few things, or search your device, which can hold thousands upon thousands of personal files, and soon, we're going to be carrying hundreds of gigs on our persons. I'm sure there's some in here now who are probably carrying hundreds of gigs on their persons.
And, a terabyte with me.
Yeah, exactly. We think that should be treated differently, and that if they were to seize things like that, there should be a judge overseeing any search of that, and that there should be probable cause for them to search any particular segment of your drive or any particular files. But right now, it is a very developing area of the law, and there's no hard rules yet.
Small follow-up question, actually, with the encryption theme. If something's encrypted on one of those pieces of technology, can you be compelled?
That is also a really interesting question that we'd probably love to litigate.
Yeah.
There are arguments that could be made that you could not be compelled, but none of them have been tested yet. But certainly, if anyone here has something of theirs seized and the government is trying to compel them to reveal their key, give us a call.
For the record, I lost all my DSA keys today. So.
Yeah. That's a topic that we've been waiting for a ripe case to handle. Again, for probably close to 10 years, I've been watching and trying to find the right case for it. One of the things that happens often in criminal cases that makes it tough to turn them into test cases is that the people often have other problems that they're dealing with other than the encrypted stuff, and they settle or they plea bargain out, and the issue that is interesting to us doesn't become the center of the case. So it's not that it doesn't happen. It's that often the situation is so complicated that the issue that we really want to pull out doesn't become the focus of the case. So that's why we haven't found the right case yet, not for want of watching.
I have another patent question. I'm trying very hard to convince my employer, who's a gigantic company, to use GPL software wherever we can. And one of the concerns is, you know, according to one of the talks that Richard gave, he made a very good point. He said it's impossible to write a program of non-trivial size and not violate some patent somewhere, which implies that pretty much every piece of software is open for challenge. And so the company is concerned that if we do adopt GPL software internally and become dependent upon it, that it'll get be subject to troll or whatever and be a huge disturbance internally. And I'm wondering if there's a way around that or some kind of assurance I can give them that that's not going to be a problem.
Yeah, I think I might actually approach that the other way around, which is any proprietary software you buy is going to have the same problem, and I have yet to see any proprietary software vendor say they will indemnify their customers from patent infringement, unless it's a private contract. I mean, if you've contracted someone to develop software for you, they might, but Microsoft, Adobe, Apple, they won't. I mean, any, you know, they won't protect you either. So I would say your best argument for using GPL software or open source free, whatever, is to say that the risk is the same, and if anything, what will happen is if you get sued, the community will probably rally around you. If you buy from a proprietary vendor, they're going to be like, ha, sorry, good luck with that. Whereas I've seen in some of these other cases where users of open source software get sued, that there's a real ability for people to come out of the woodwork and support them, help find prior art, serve as experts, things like that. So you might actually engender some goodwill in that sense. I mean, I think one example real quick that you could look at, not in the patent context, but more in the copyright, is when SCO, you know, started going after Linux and IBM stepped in to defend, a lot of people actually got a different viewpoint of IBM as a company. Now, it's a little different because IBM was a distributor, you know, themselves of the binaries and things, but I think you could position a company so that you actually got a lot of support and goodwill from using open source so that if you were sued, you would have some resources.
Thank you.
And you could apply the money you'd save on licenses to subsequent legal fees.
Or to EFF's patent busting project.
My question is, what is EFF doing on net neutrality?
Well, okay, I'll talk about this a little. Here's the thing. EFF doesn't have a...
Yeah, we own a
what
truck.
What about the tubes, exactly? It's not a truck, okay? I want to be clear about this. So EFF doesn't have a formal position on net neutrality, and I think that it's probably fair to start with our board of directors to explain why. We have David Farber on our board of directors, and we have Lawrence Lessig on our board of directors, two people whose opinion we respect tremendously, who disagree very sharply on this issue. I'll tell you our uncomfortable, you know, in general, we're fans of net neutrality. I mean, all packets are packets, and they need to be treated equally as they go across the internet. That's a fundamentally important principle. The thing that is worrisome to us about the way the net neutrality debate is playing in Congress is that people want to give the ability to control and regulate the internet to the Federal Communications Commission. That's the solution that the pro-network neutrality people are doing. You can't tell that unless you look pretty deeply into what they're saying. You won't see it in the funny little flashes or the op-ed pieces that are being placed all over the place. But, you know, we care about actually how things get implemented at EFF, not just the sound bites. What they're trying to implement is to give jurisdiction to the Federal Communications Commission to regulate the internet, to regulate the packets on the internet, and hope that the Federal Communications System Commission, which has not stood up for consumers in the 6 years I've been at EFF, and we've been fighting the broadcast flag. We had to sue them, remember, earlier, because they were doing Hollywood's bidding, and we won, and now they're going to Congress to get this authority. Why do you want to give those monsters the ability to decide about whether packets are being fairly passed across the internet? This is the problem that we have. This is the struggle that we're having. Everybody at EFF is strongly in favor of network neutrality, but the devil's in the details about how you go about fixing it. And the current proposals in Congress right now make us extremely nervous. We've tried to lobby the FCC. We've tried to make sure that consumers' voices, ordinary people's voices are heard at that agency. And frankly, we haven't been successful. The people who are successful there are the people who have the money and who are the players. And the biggest players at the FCC right now is the duopoly. It's Verizon. It's the big telcos. So this is where we have uneasiness about the way the network neutrality debate is being framed right now, and that's why you don't see EFF having a front position. This is the source of our discomfort with the way the debate is playing out now. We're watching it closely. Believe me, we're part of this. As I said, we've got two of the leading voices on each side of it on our board. There is an ongoing discussion at EFF in this, but that's why you haven't seen us out front on network neutrality. And, if we come up with a silver bullet solution, you'll see us, but we're still trying to figure out how to do it. But I don't think giving the FCC the authority to regulate the Internet is the answer to this problem or, frankly, any other.
A follow-up comment? One more example of why you probably don't want to trust the FCC to regulate the Internet. They've also bent over for the FBI and DOJ in applying CALEA, the Communications Assistance for Law Enforcement Act, to the Internet to make all of the networks tappable. These are not the people you want to hand this power to.
Just a follow-up comment. As someone who has contributed to you guys for a long time, I am specifically looking to you for guidance for the industry. So I'm not necessarily looking for you to come down on one side or the other, but I'm a regular reader of Effector. I really want to see your position and elevate the conversation so that it didn't come up until now. I would like to see you the first thing when you come up to the table to say, I need to be talking about net neutrality so that we all understand what the issues are.
Okay. We have a paper that's in the works right now, and again, I can't give you a deadline on when we're going to come out on it because we really, this is an important issue. It's a critical issue, and EFF, we view ourselves as, we don't want to be irresponsible about what we say about this, and so I hear you, and we are working on it, and I think you can, we'll work on trying to get something out front about our uneasiness and where we see the issues.
All right, thank you.
Hi, I have a question about government databases that track a lot of our personal information, the stuff that's both in the commercial sector and the banking and stuff like that, that they then will, a lot of times the government can't directly access the information, so they'll contact third parties to gather it and collect it for them. I actually have two parts. One is, what's the current legality of them being able to gather a lot of this information into databases like we've heard about, like TIA, Matrix, and stuff like that? Mm-hmm. And then also, is there anything that we can do, like from a disclosure standpoint, so the stuff that they tend to try to keep out of the public media, that we can try and bring that into the public forum?
Okay. As to the first part of your question, there is something called the Privacy Act, which requires the government to publish details when they build databases on U.S. citizens. And to apply fair information practices such that you can find out what records they have on you, you can get them changed if they're incorrect, et cetera, et cetera. The problem is there are very broad carve-outs in that law for law enforcement and national security-related databases. So in a lot of ways, it's kind of the Wild West. The latest twist on this is that instead of developing their own databases, FBI, DOJ, certainly NSA. They are now all clients of the data brokers, your Choice Points, your Axioms, et cetera, et cetera. These are the companies that collect every possible record on you that they can. Their audience has typically been marketers. Now their biggest client is the government, particularly post 9/11. This is a hard issue. It is primarily a policy issue, which is why I'm glad you bring up how do we bring this into the public eye. I wish I had an answer to that. The fact is, it's been revealed that the NSA has compromised all of the major internet and phone switches in the country, and no one gives a damn, except for people like you. How do you make people care? I don't know. Cindy, you got a good answer for that? I wish I had one.
Well, I mean, we try, right? I mean, we make funny little videos, and we come to speak, and we
sue people.
We sue people. and we try to as much as we can, but we've got a pretty tiny voice. Unfortunately, what it takes to get the public's attention in this country is a hell of a lot more money than my budget, right? You buy the TV ads, you buy the New York Times ads or wherever, right, and try to permeate the public. I wish that I had the budget for one Celine Dion CD, right, the promotional budget for one Celine Dion CD. We could we can make a much bigger splash than we can make. So we, you know, we're nimble, we're quick, we do as much as we can with the small resources that we have. But I think the, you know, word of mouth is the best way. Viral marketing of these ideas. You got to talk to your family, you got to talk to your friends. The best way to get people on this bandwagon is if a good trusted friend of theirs explains it to them and tells them why it's important. And that's priceless. I think this is the last question, so.
Okay.
Sorry.
I just wanted to personally thank all of you for fighting the good fight in a legal way. And it's really performing a great service for us all. But basically, I just want, you know, as you're progressing with what you do and, you know, making FOIA requests and just all that stuff on a legal level and all the difficulties that, you know, you encounter, right, with the culture of secrecy in the government that sort of thing, just sort of on a feeling level, and I'm directing this to each one of you individually, could you briefly summarize kind of like what's the, you know, the strongest feeling that comes forth if you think back on what you've, you know, done so far, and maybe also for the future? Are you optimistic, mostly frustrated, and also in a world that, you know, that the public kind of doesn't get these issues kind of like we do?
Well, I'll start. Sometimes I'm frustrated, admittedly. The trends are all in the wrong direction these days. You look, everywhere you look, there's some new encroachment, some new privacy invasion, some new way of stifling speech online. That's frustrating, but it's also inspiring. It's why we're here. And so every time we turn around and see that new awful thing, it just rededicates us and makes us care even more about what we're doing and realize that we made the right choice in being a part of EFF.
Thank you for your kind words, and I think one of the things that helps us keep going is the support of people like yourself, like those in the audience. And we're trying to fight the good fight, and there's a lot of troubling things out there. But we want to not give anything up without a fight, and try and make a future that we would want to live in. I think we're pretty much out of time, so
yeah.
Thank you
all. I'll tell you, one of the best things that we do every year is we come to DEF CON. We go back to EFF, and we're so rededicated to working for you guys. So thank you.